Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome and thank you for joining us today. This is an hour, one of only two remaining on Hay House Radio, devoted solely to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and you can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat, where my partner Ravinder and her team will greet you. Now, I want to remind you that our last show on Hay House Radio will be the 27th of August. That's next week. We did struggle with the decision to leave, but so many of you have repeatedly asked for a two-hour show that we finally decided to create one. Consequently, we will be launching our new two-hour Provocative Enlightenment program this coming January on a new network with some truly exciting guests and a new extended format. And we'll still have all the specials that we currently have, our chat room and the movies, and we'll be able to share a lifetime as we do now. We hope that you will join us. Now, between the time of our last Hay House show in January, we have something truly fantastic happening, something Ravinder came up with, something she wanted. So I'll let her tell you all about it.
We're really looking forward to it. It is the Breaking Limitations teleseminar series. You know, the idea behind our radio show, you know, we want to have the two-hour format, but and the Breaking Limitations will be the two-hour format, but we'll be taking everything in a great deal more depth. It will be very practical. You will have tools and tips every single session that you can put into effect right away. We are interviewing some of the best of the best. You know, we've got Marcy Shymoff, Joan Borisenko, Robert Holden, a whole bunch of other people. It is the best of the best. I am really pleased with the amazing authors who have agreed to join us, but we will be discussing in depth, how did I get here and how do I get where I want to be? As I said, this will be a very practical teleseminar series. Each one will build on the other. There'll be time to play them again. To register for this, simply go to eldontaylor.com. We've got a nice big banner at the top of the page. Click on that, sign in, and then we will send you all the information for it. I am really hoping that you will all join us there. It's a continuation of our Hay House journey, so it's definitely the next place to go. So just go to eldontaylor.com, click on the large banner at the top that says Breaking Limitations, and register. I will see you there.
Okay, and once again, there's no cost for that. So our last show with Hay House will be on the 27th of August, and on that day, we will have a sort of trip down memory lane. We invite all of you to phone in and share with us what you like best about our show. What guests did you like best? What did you learn from the show? How did the show impact your life? And so on. We will have gifts for every caller. Indeed, Mrs. Santa, as she's come to be known.
Mama Claus
will be in the house, and you will be able to choose any InterTalk program or any one of my books as your gift for sharing. This is the last Mrs. Santa episode on Hay House, so be sure to join us. We would appreciate your blessings. Okay, every week I read some of your letters as our way of celebrating your input. Last week our show was all about alien abductions. We shared some of the testimony of former Canadian Defense Minister Paul Hellyer, who testified knowing of four alien races that visit Earth. Our guest confirmed Hellyer's testimony and added some truly interesting elements to the entire matter. Steve wrote, "This interview was interesting. I would enjoy seeing more research of the DNA from the people making these claims that you brought up during the interview." Jane wrote, "Hi, Eldon, just listening to the show. Wonder if it has occurred to Miss Stoner that she could be an alien who has incarnated on this planet. Why are aliens always thought to be bad? Why can't they be a positive force for good? And are angels aliens?" Well, I don't have a comment on that. Rebecca wrote, "Mr. Taylor, good show. Tuned in tonight for the first time. I'd like to comment that your remarks to Denise, that she was short on words, ask Kathleen, were condescending, especially when Denise was discussing some very personal and controversial information already. Perhaps a little more tact next time would be appreciated by not only your guests, but your listeners as well. Well, Rebecca, your comment is duly noted. However, I disagree with you. There was some humor, but nothing in context that was in any way demeaning or condescending. That said, when you choose to go public with something and agree to a public interview, then expect to be asked questions that the audience and the interviewer expect you to answer. Moving on, Michael wrote, Eldon, I really enjoy your show. I am sorry to see that you are leaving Hay House. I am one of your fans that think your topics deserve 2 hours. I hope I can still listen to your show over the Internet. I love Hay House, but I think they are missing out on something great. Well, thanks, Mike. And you can count that whichever of the two networks we're looking at, they both have a great Internet interface, and we'll insist on that. Carla wrote, what? You won't be on Hay House Radio anymore? Be sure to keep us posted as regards your activities. Without you, the collective IQ of online radio will drop at least 25 points. Now, that's cute, Carla, and I admit loving your comment, but somehow I don't think it's too accurate. Brian wrote, ooh, how provocative. 2 hour shows coming up soon. Watch out, George Nuri. I think George is safe, but Madeline wrote, I am so very excited to know about your new 2 hour radio talk show, soon to start in January. Looking forward to continued great topics and your lovely Ravinder. You like that, Princess?
Yeah, that's cool.
Kushkus wrote, Mr. Taylor, sad to hear you are leaving Hay House. I tune in every time and love your show, but happy to know it's for a better option. Excited to hear about your new program. January cannot come soon enough. Marianne wrote, hi, Eldon. First, let me say that I am so inspired by your presence and ability to be a real person here and on Facebook. There are so many famous authors, much like yourself, who are, well, you know, too cool for us. So I am touched by your organic expression and unity. You know, Marianne, as far as I'm concerned, we all put our pants on one leg at a time. And, you know, when we start thinking that we're special in any way, shape, or form, we've lost the message. Now, Lawrence wrote, I feel that this InnerTalk work is groundbreaking and evolutionary for the state of human mind and removing old negative inhibiting behaviors. I am extremely excited and grateful to you for giving us this work. Kelly wrote, I have been using InnerTalk for a few years with great success. I recently started using the Ozo Confidence CD. I love how assertive and self-assured I feel after listening to it. Davey wrote, your grief and trauma programs are very helpful. Remember, those programs are free at my website. You can just simply download them. And Todd wrote, love your book, What If? Well, thanks, Todd. It's a book that will challenge most people in one way or another because it's supposed to, through the many thought experiments, lead you into discovering inconsistencies, dissonance, and so forth in your private beliefs. In this way, you have the opportunity to free yourself of what I think of as thought shackles. Now, while we're on the subject of thought shackles, Hay House has asked me to provide a special training course designed to uncover and release negative patterns while replacing them with genuinely helpful and beneficial new habits. As I worked on building this course, I could see that one of those two-hour events simply wouldn't cut it. So Hay House and I agreed to 6 hours of online training that will take place over a 3-day period. The training will all be available, obviously, in the comfort of your home. You don't need to travel, and you'll be able to ask questions and more. Now, this training will begin in November, so be sure to register to receive my free e-newsletter so you will get all of the insider information on this and other special upcoming events. To do that, just go to eldentaylor.com. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldentaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming, and we thank you for your continued support and feedback. Now to today's show, Supernormal, Science and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities, with our special guest, Dr. Dean Radin. Now, I have poked holes in some really screwy ideas that have been presented as science over the past 3 years on this very show. When we heard that those who experienced an NDE gained IQ points, indeed, some returning with IQs well over 200, we wanted to know the instrument that was used to conjure those quotients. When we were told that the quantum double slit experiment proved without a doubt that mind interacted with matter, we pushed back with the explanation accepted by almost, 99.9% of all the scientific community. When we were told that virtues were culturally relative, we pointed out that to instantiate that argument, one must accept many atrocities around the world, including genocide. For if a culture could decide what was right or wrong, then there was no possibility of an absolute value, including life itself. Accepting the idea that right and wrong are culturally defined, or for that matter, individually defined, is akin to throwing values out altogether. Why not just admit the idea that no matter what happened anywhere, it's okay? Because tacitly, that's exactly what you are doing with this form of nonsense. When we brought Michael Shermer to the show, we expected an unreasonable cynic, and instead we found that his brand of skepticism was ours as well, and that his concluding statements regarding how he would do nothing different with his life today than how he currently conducted it, had he remained an evangelical Christian, informed all of us that he shared our principle. Service was the key to a happy life. When we were informed that thoughts create everything, and therefore if your life sucks, it's because you are making it that way, we made fodder of that notion. We pointed out that the Afghan girl who had her nose and ears cut off by her Taliban husband could hardly be thought of as causing that event, and that was to say nothing of victims of other atrocities, including the Holocaust. How ignoble a thought to condemn everyone who ever experienced true misfortune by blaming them for somehow thinking in a way that attracted the deed. Now, there are many other instances over the past 3 years of provocative enlightenment where we have challenged what I think of as misinformation, disinformation, myth, and pure unmitigated rubbish. What we have tried to do for 3 years on this program is untangle the many BS stories from the facts. As I have said before, in my opinion, the real miasma of the so-called New Age is the willingness to believe anything and anybody that champions a favored position, despite evidence to the contrary. And of course, if that champion happens to have a credential behind their name, well then, they may be elevated as heroes of the cause. Usually this is explained as their willingness to risk being ostracized by their peers in order to bring the truth to the public. In this way, they seem to believe that they have successfully positioned themselves as another Galileo, fighting the establishment. But the notion is also false. Oh, wait. It is factually false, but many folks nevertheless buy into it anyway. I enter today's guest, a man who has made a career out of testing ideas that many have found too preposterous to even consider. A man with impeccable credentials, and in his new book, Supernormal, Dr. Dean Radin states, and I'm going to quote, "I once gave a lecture for a university Psy-Chi group, the International Honor Society for Student Psychologists. I presented the results of experiments my team had conducted, investigating how one person's focused thoughts aimed at another person, isolated at a distance, affected the remote person's autonomic nervous system. We found that this version of the feeling of being stared at, you remember Rupert Sheldrake, we talked about that here on the air, phenomena demonstrated under strictly controlled conditions that sometimes those sensations were quite real. The students listened attentively and asked good questions afterward. Then as the meeting was adjourning, a red-faced faculty advisor sitting in the back of the room suddenly jumped up, rushed to the front of the room waving a batch of papers, and hurriedly passed them out to students. Curious about this strange behavior and the advisor's flushed appearance, I borrowed one of the papers and saw that it contained a long list of books and articles written by hardcore debunkers. The advisor breathlessly explained to the students that this was his last of recommended his list of recommended reading about the paranormal, and that he expected them to read it. What he didn't say was that this was his attempt to eradicate any possible contaminating influence I might have had. In the balance of it all, there is truth in the supernormal, as there is exaggeration in some of the nonsense. Okay, then, can you really unleash inherent supernormal mental powers, such as telepathy, clairvoyance, and precognition, and do so at will? Is it really possible to perceive another person's thoughts and intentions, influence objects with our minds, envision future events? And is it possible that some of the superpowers described in ancient legends are actually real and waiting for us? Well, these are some of the questions that we have for our guest today. So let me tell you a little something about Dr. Radin. Dean Radin, Ph.D., is the author of Entangled Minds and the Conscious Universe. For more than two decades, he has been engaged in research on the frontiers of consciousness. He has held appointments at Princeton University and several Silicon Valley think tanks, including SRI International, where he worked on a classified program investigating psychic phenomena for the U.S. government. And we have had several of those folks on this show. He is the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, and best-selling author of The Conscious Universe, and the author of the new book, a great book, the book we're featuring today, Supernormal. So let's get him in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. Dean Radin.
Thank you, Eldon. I'm happy to be here.
That's our pleasure indeed. To begin with, I like your work, and I do believe that you walk a fine line. You and I have actually exchanged correspondence in the past. I think the last time was about your study involving chocolates. You heard the setup piece as well, so correct me if you think I'm wrong. But isn't one of the largest stumbling blocks that you must deal with when interfacing with the scientific community due in large to the nonsense and ridiculous claims or assertions that are often proliferated among the so-called New Agers?
Absolutely. Yes. What your opening comment is completely accurate as far as I'm concerned. That when we are facing a controversy, we always have to wonder, well, what's inflaming the controversy? And in this case, it's not so much what we get from scientists. There's a lot of pushback from the mainstream, but a lot of the pushback is stimulated by claims which have no scientific basis at all, and worse, that and oftentimes it's something that is demonstrably wrong. And so, of course, that this is quite upsetting, and it's worth pointing it out repeatedly.
And sometimes people just seem to put words in. I mean, I have seen words put in your mouth. I actually said, no, wait a minute, that is not something that Dr. Radin has said. Have you encountered that yourself?
All the time. Yeah, and in both directions. From enthusiasts, they will say, Dean Radin has proved such and such. From the organized skeptical community, they will say, Dean Radin has failed to indicate anything. And of course, I really do try to fit in the middle. I'm on a seesaw balance. One foot is firmly placed within mainstream science. That's the tools and techniques that we use. But the other foot is in the great unwashed area of human experience where much of it is not being looked at. So I am interested in the broad range of human experience and use the tools of science to study it. Sometimes we find evidence for things and sometimes we don't.
You know, and I think, you know, what you're really doing is, and I would say it differently, but you correct me if you see it that I'm wrong, but you have one foot solidly in the foundation of science and another foot in the frontier of science because you are investigating areas. I mean, that's what science is about, observation, investigation, form a hypothesis, do the research. So I guess for me, I have a great deal of difficulty with those folks that tend to think of science as belonging in an area other than looking at the human experience, looking at what we think of as white crows, to use a metaphor of William James.
Right. Well, yes, your description, I guess, is accurate as well. Much of what I do is could be subsumed within psychology or maybe social psychology, but it also significantly overlaps with physics. And so one of the problems we have is that in order to be a scientist today, you spend your 20 years in education and then the rest of your life studying a very, very thin slice of the physical world or of reality. And that's necessary because there's so much known in any given area now that to become a real expert in a topic, you need to focus on that. And so if something comes along that's outside your topic, that seems a little bit strange, scientists tend to be smart, and they know they're smart, and they're rewarded for that, and they will have an opinion about a topic that they actually don't know anything about. And I see this, and this is frustrating, I see this oftentimes in the media where I or a colleague will present a result of an experiment, and then they ask some random professor somewhere, well, what do you think of this? Well, they don't know the topic. They don't know the details of the study. They don't know anything. So what they offer is basically a layman's perspective or an expectation about what they think of it. And, of course, not knowing a topic, their opinion is not really worth very much.
No, that's absolutely right. You not only have that, but you've got the resistance within the paradigm, kind of the Thomas Kuhn model of what it takes to break through a scientific paradigm. But while we're on that subject, I loved your book, The Conscious Universe, but there have been some criticism. And one of them that, I mean, most of them I just dismissed, but one of them I need to ask you. This is provocative enlightenment. Andrew Enderby has essentially said that you have left out, you omitted relevant studies. Did you knowingly do that? And if so, why?
What Andrew's
in your meta-analyses.
Right. What this is actually almost funny when you think about it. When I reported the results of the Ganzfeld telepathy experiments, that's what he's talking about.
Right.
Which I report in The Conscious Universe and Entangled Minds, and again, the updating it in Supernormal. We're looking specifically at experiments using this particular technique, Ganzfeld. This is a kind of a sensory stimulation method, but with unpatterned stimuli. And it's designed to get you into a hypnagogic state, a kind of dreamlike state, to encourage you to pay attention to subtle impressions, because you're not getting any patterned stimuli from the outside world.
Right.
So this method is developed over 40 years. It's been repeatedly done now, something like 4,500 times. And overall, with that database, you get a 32% hit rate, where 25% is expected by chance. So the odds against chance of getting that difference between 32 and 25%, it doesn't sound like much, but from a statistical point of view, the odds against chance are a gazillion to one. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally trillions and trillions to one. So that provides a very nice database to work with. But what Andrew was saying is, wait a minute, you've left out lots and lots of other telepathy experiments, which is true, but those other experiments don't use the Ganzfeld method. That's why they were left out, because when you do a meta-analysis, you want to be sure that you're including apples with apples and not apples and oranges. Nevertheless, you can go ahead and look at the database that Andrew painstakingly put together, which contains not 4,500 sessions, but 6,500 sessions or even more, lots and lots of additional sessions. So what is the overall hit rate on that? Well, that's about 30%.
Right.
As compared to 25% by chance. And what's the odds against chance? It's trillions and trillions and trillions to one. So the funny part of this is, yes, the meta-analysis certainly has exclusionary criteria, as all of them do.
I'm going to have to hold you right there, Dr. Reed, and we have a hard break coming up. I don't want the computer to cut it off. We'll pick that up after the break. We're speaking with Dr. Dean Radin about his work and book, Supernormal. If you haven't read the book, you're going to want to read the book. If you're not already in our chat room, now is a great time to join in the conversation. We have a special video clip for you today featuring our guest. You can join the fun by logging in at eldentaylor.com/chat. Do stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Dean Radin about his work and book, Supernormal. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook as a friend or a fan. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and register for the upcoming free teleseminar series, Breaking Limitations. All right, before the break, Dr. Radin was, I believe, pointing out that even after the objection regarding omitted studies, that the significance was still in the trillions, demonstrating the effect. The effects were not a result of pure chance. Have I got that about right, Dr. Radin?
That's correct.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, and I want to get into your book, but, you know, the opportunity to speak with you personally, I must admit, is too tempting for me to let some things go. So before we get into the book, one of your studies consisted of an attempt to replicate the work of Emoto. Mm-hmm. I would truly like to believe that thought intention can be distilled and demonstrated in water crystals. But every expert I have spoken with that knows anything about the subject finds his work, let's say unscientific. My pretty bride, Ravinder, who for years spent her days in the lab as a microbiologist looking down the microscope, finds Emoto's work to be nothing more than a forced outcome based on wishful thinking. I reviewed your study, and it appeared to me that you failed to replicate his work. That is, you didn't get those same pretty pictures everyone has seen. Do you wish to add to this, Rav?
When I went through Emoto's book, I found gaping holes in the science there. You know, the type of thing anyone who thinks back to the science they did in high school will just be aware of. You know, he in one place he says that he didn't get the same crystals twice. In another place he says that he would do 100 replications of the blessed water and 100 replications of the bad water, and he would get 3 of them in the blessed water, but it took a year's worth of training in order to see it. You know, I did work in a path lab. I'm very familiar with looking down a microscope, and if it takes you a year's worth of training to be able to identify that and you only get 3 of them, well, it sounds to me like he wasn't looking very hard in the unblessed water. And that is just the tip of the iceberg. I continued doing research and it went on.
But you read Dr. Radin's study and you liked the study.
His study was tight. The protocol was perfect. It was right on.
Okay. And I agree with that. So Dr. Radin, the question is, do you believe, one, that your study was a replication? And two, do you think Emoto's method of doing this, the freezer, the microscope, it is legitimate science?
Well, he will admit that he's more of an artist than a scientist. And when I saw him give a presentation and he was showing the beautiful crystals and the ugly crystals and so on, afterwards I went up and asked what basically any scientist would ask, would you be willing to do this under double-blind conditions? Because the concern is that he's selecting the images that match what he wants to see.
Right.
And to my surprise and delight, he said, sure, he'd love to do a double-blind experiment. So that's what led to our study. He invited me to go to Tokyo and into his walk-in freezer and watch the process happen. And I decided that flying to Tokyo and spending a week in a walk-in freezer was not something I wanted to do. So instead, I said, well, why don't we do this? I'll prepare the water. I will send it to you. You have your best technician take pictures of it, but I'm not going to tell you which sample of water has been treated and which hasn't. And
right.
that created the double blind, or at least the single blind on their side.
Right.
And then the evaluation of the crystals was also blind, where I created a website with the photos of the various crystals and asked people to simply judge how beautiful they thought the crystal was.
Right.
So that's a subjective assessment, but nevertheless, it would go along the same direction of what Dr. Emoto was claiming, that these are more beautiful crystals than those. And so the bottom line is that from a statistical point of view, there is a significant, just barely significant difference between the treated and the untreated crystals, slightly more beautiful crystals for the treated ones. So I would say that is a replication in principle, but it is certainly not a replication that when you think about the water, it magically becomes beautiful. It shifts a little bit, but just, I mean, you wouldn't be able to see it without statistics.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems, that, of course, that I have with that is statistics aren't a thing, and we both know how data is not a deed. So, but all right, that's a straightforward. It was a tight protocol. I looked at the pictures myself. I made the comparisons. I've had conversations there. I've heard two different stories, and so, you know, that's why the question. Let's go into your new book. If I were to ask you why you wrote this book, how would you answer that?
Part of it is to bring the data up to date. The last book I wrote was 2006, and the evidence is continuing to progress and accelerate in some ways. But specifically focusing on yoga and meditation, because both of those topics are now mainstream. They're no longer considered exotic imports from the East or from somewhere else.
Right.
They're mainstream. You can find yoga studios all over the place.
Right.
And so it occurred to me that the kind of yoga and, to some extent, meditation that are practiced in the West, there's such a strong sense of exclusion of unusual abilities in the West because of the reasons we discussed earlier. There are a lot of exaggerations. That when yoga is taught, meditation is taught, it's very, very different than the original idea of what yoga was about. And the original yoga, classic yoga, as reported by the Indian sage Patanjali 2,000 years ago, the goal basically was enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not everyone has the talent and discipline to be able to get there, but along the way, it is said, according to the yogic lore, that we develop certain supernormal capacities, which today we would call most of them psychic abilities. So, okay, there we have these legends. In today's world, we tend to dismiss the ancient lore as superstition. Even among, in the academic world, scholars of religion, they study these things and know the lore in great detail, but they generally, most of them, dismiss the stories of supernormal capacities as hagiography, as exaggerations, and that are not true or even cannot be true. And partially this is reflecting the culture that we live in. We live in a culture where the educated people kind of scoff at the old superstitions because now we're modern and sophisticated and we all have iPhones and smartphones. So, an argument can be made, by the way, that if those ancient peoples were so smart, and how come they didn't develop the iPhone? Well, you know, there's a serious question there. Our technologies tell us in a very pragmatic way that we have learned something about the physical world that apparently they didn't know back then. So,
and or we have a need, some might say, I don't mean to interrupt you, and or we have a need they didn't have. I mean, Julian James, in his breakdown of the bicameral mind, suggests that there was a time we communicated mentally. We didn't need to orally express something.
That is a possibility. Nevertheless, from our perspective now, we look back at what amounts to the Stone Age living conditions, where life expectancy might be 30, and there's enormous amounts of suffering that has been alleviated by modern science.
Right.
So, you know, was the urge among the original yogis and in Buddhism, it was a very strong emphasis on alleviating suffering, and we've done a much better job of that now, and not through meditation, but through technology. So, but nevertheless, there we have legends that go way back about these powers that are supposedly developed through meditation, and the description of how it happens and what happens is in great detail. So it occurred to me, okay, we're sitting on about a century's worth of scientific experiments on various kinds of psychic abilities. Those same abilities in the ancient yogic lore would be considered elementary. These are things that almost anybody can develop with sufficient discipline. So we can now look back to that literature and say, given now that there are tens of millions of people around the world who are doing these practices, they're doing a modern version of it, but nevertheless, they're doing yoga and meditation. What's going to happen to all these people who are doing this, who may not be aware of the fact that the practice itself will eventually give rise to, at minimum, very strange synchronicities and precognitive dreams and the whole range of things that we consider to be psychic? So I thought it might be interesting to write a book that's, first of all, talks about yoga and meditation from the modern and the ancient perspective, and about the inherent capabilities that will be enhanced as a result, and then look at the evidence from a scientific perspective to see whether there's any reason to expect that these phenomena are actually real. So that's kind of the story of the book.
It is a great book. It is a great book. Philosophically, I think when you look at the origin of yoga and within its context, for all intent and purposes, enlightenment includes understanding the difference between perception, conception, and to those yogis. This world, for all intent and purposes, is illusory. Investing in this world may be the very reason that avoiding investing in this world may be the very reason that intellect wasn't brought to bear on some of the toys that we know today, like our cell phones. Mm-hmm. That said, you have a great deal of experimental work that's going on right now, and I kind of like to go into it. I want to make sure that everybody knows where they can get your book in case we get too deep end on this, and how to reach out to you. So I'm going to ask you to tell everybody now how they can get your book and how they can reach out to you, how they can learn more about what's going on, and then let's get right into some of the work that you're doing.
Okay. Well, I created a website called supernormalbook.com that gives an overview of the book, and you can read the first chapter, and there's a whole bunch of buttons going to bookstores. It's also in bookstores. I mean, the actual physical book is in bookstores, and you can get it from Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those usual places. To find a book, you can just either supernormalbook.com or go to Google or anywhere books are sold.
It is a good book, I'm going to tell you. I mean, my recommendation is you're going to want to read the book. Now, we had Peter Calhoun, who passed away a couple of weeks ago now, on our show about a month ago. And Peter is an American shaman who claimed to have opened his cities and gained great power as a result of that, not just in an enlightenment, if you will, but in abilities to communicate with animals. You spend some time on cities. You make several references. Tell us how you awaken them and what one could expect if they do awaken the cities.
Well, one thing I want to make clear is that two things. One is that a city is a Sanskrit term, roughly meaning perfection or attainment.
Right.
It's in today's terms, it's a supernormal capacity, like psychic ability. The means by which these things appear is through a meditative state called samadhi, which is a very deep form of absorption, in which the distinctions between you and the rest of the world begin to fade away. So that means that the distinction between you and me and here and there and now and then, all of those binary types of distinctions that we're always making, they go away. In a full samadhi state, we might consider it to be something like a mystical condition where you perceive the world in a holistically. In fact, there's no you really anymore. It's just somehow there's a holistic environment in which you have awareness. That's step one. If you can't reach that state, then you can't develop the cities. So to develop an actual ability, you go into samadhi, and then you maintain an object of attention while in samadhi. So this sounds a little bit paradoxical, because how can you be in a holistic condition and yet maintain an intention? Nevertheless, right. That's what you do. You pull back just enough so that you can maintain an object of attention. So if you wanted to gain the power of telepathy, you go into this very deep absorption state, and you think about the person, or you hold the person that you wish to be telepathic with in your awareness. And by so doing, you've carved out a little bit of the holism and include focus on this one person. And in the absorption state, the distinctions between you and that person dissolve. And so in some deep sense, you and that person are the same. This is why you know their thoughts. You know a lot more than their thoughts. You know their whole history and everything else, because you've reduced the separation. The illusion of separation is gone, and you are that person in some sense. And this right. can be done for many other kinds of objects. So if you take an object or an idea of causation, simply the idea of causation, that things occur through time, and you become absorbed with that idea, you will know the past, present, and future. We call that precognition. So this is essentially the prescription that is given in the Yoga Sutras, that if you want to develop this power, you think about these things. You want to develop that power, you think about those things in the state of samadhi. That's essentially what the prescription is. And by the way, it is made very clear in the Yoga Sutras and in many other texts that just because you develop these abilities says absolutely nothing about your spiritual development. And in fact, there are lots of warnings that are said repeatedly that if you begin to develop the siddhis, don't demonstrate them and don't even talk about them. Don't talk about it, because they are powers. Powers are corrupting, and you will become Darth Vader if you talk about it.
That's very interesting. I have to ask this. You're familiar with the practices. You've obviously explored the Vedantic literature. Have you worked at opening a city, you yourself?
Well, if I had and I were successful, constraint...
I'm not going to ask you if you're successful. I'm just going to ask you, have you worked at it?
In order to start working at it, you need to be able to sustain samadhi as long as you wish, perhaps for hours.
Right.
And I can't do that. My meditative practice is elementary compared to what is necessary to do that. So you know, I've probably had moments of samadhi that last a second or two, but that's not long enough. It's not sufficiently under my control to be able to even approach the development of the cities in the yogic sense.
Okay. Let me ask you this now. With all the research that you've got going on, you're working on global consciousness projects. And I understand that you've got experiments going with oolong tea, experiments with the interactions between mind and light, and the brain activity among mediums. What is the most compelling area that you're working on right now in terms of what we can expect as evidence for the paranormal? Or supernormal, as you call it.
Right. I tend not to focus too much on any one experiment. I pay a lot more attention to classes of experiments, because it's in science, a single experiment doesn't prove anything. And right. Unless you're a physicist working at the Large Hadron Collider, where it costs $1 billion to run one experiment. For everywhere else in science, you do an experiment, and then you repeat it a lot, and then you get your colleagues to repeat it, and it's in the preponderance of repeated evidence where you start to gain confidence. So I would say then that while the experiments I'm doing, I'm enjoying them, and we're getting some good results, but the proof of the pudding really is not only that we can repeat it, but that our colleagues can repeat it. So with that as background, one of the areas that we're finding to be pretty robust is what I call presentiment. And this is an unconscious form of precognition. that you measure through changes in bodily conditions, like skin conductance and heart rate and that sort of thing. So that I started that in mid-1990s, and now there's something like 40 replications from 15 labs around the world, and it's very clear that the effects that I had originally seen in my own lab have been repeated by others elsewhere. That's what makes the evidence become credible in the scientific sense. And realistically, it also it helps resolve my own concerns about experiments that I do, because we try hard not to make mistakes, but it's easy to make a mistake when you do an experiment. So you have to rely on somebody completely independently trying the same thing. And so it's a great sense of relief if somebody else does the experiment and actually ends up with the same result.
Describe how that experiment is actually conducted, would you?
So you wire somebody up to look at their brain waves or their skin conductance or some measure that reflects unconscious activity in your mind. You sit them down in front of a computer screen, and they press a button, and 5 seconds later, they know that a picture will appear. Picture could be calm, it could be very emotional, but the choice of the picture is done by a true random number generator immediately before the picture shows up. So when you press the button and you're waiting the 5 seconds for something to show up, nobody knows what's going to happen. It could be a picture chosen from a very large pool of pictures, and so no one knows in advance. Even the computer doesn't know, because the random generator selects it immediately before it's shown. So that five-second period, then, is dealing with an unpredictable future. The question is, what is your physiology doing just 5 seconds before you see a calm picture, like an astronaut, as compared to 5 seconds before seeing a very emotional picture, which might be an erotic picture, or it might be a car crash, or something like that, something emotional. And the hypothesis was that if some aspect of our attention is spread out through time, as in precognition, then maybe that spreading out through time happens in your mind, but in terms of your body, that the information ripples backwards in time and gets your body prepared for what you're about to experience, which would make a lot of sense from an evolutionary point of view.
Sure.
It's always good to be aware of what's
reaction.
About So we make a prediction then about what does the physiology look like before two dramatically different kinds of pictures, and you do the experiment, and you get a result. I mean, you can see a difference in physiology. Before a calm picture, you remain calm, and before an emotional picture, you start to get more emotional. So that's the kind of experiment using a wide range of stimuli, sometimes pictures, sometimes something as simple as a light flash, sometimes loud sounds. Lots of different physiological measures have been tried, and across the board, it seems as though the body does have an ability to outguess unpredictable futures, which we can call precognition.
Right. And this is probably, in my view, the most compelling evidence that exists out there right now for precognition. And it's yours. You own it. You came up with it. You know, we're out of time. I want to repeat your website. It's supernormal.com. Is that correct, Dr. Radin?
No. Supernormalbook.com.
Supernormalbook.com. Again, my recommendation is, if you haven't read this one, you're missing a real opportunity to be informed about where science and parascience, as I call it around here, interface. Well, we've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I want to thank the team at Hay House Radio for making what we do so pleasurable. I hope you enjoyed our show, and I hope that you'll enjoy us again next week as our last show here at Hay House. Until then, remember, wherever you are in the world, believing in yourself always matters.